in which we participate relate to the percentage of the time that we meet statutory time frames. Like I said, we have several. That would be how we set cases, issuance of orders, and then our appeal time at the board itself. Several things affect our workload. Requests for hearings, obviously. Requests for board review. Budgeting, population shifts as the population moves throughout the state, demographics, and then any legislative changes we see. That basically concludes my presentation, unless there are questions.
Maureen, I'm curious. do you folks track, and I know it's difficult when you may rule against someone, but do you track the issue that we've had a lot of folks that we've asked them to discuss, and that is kind of customer satisfaction, what kind of a response do you get, how they were treated? And I'll probably talk with you later if I can. I'll get a hold of you as soon as I reach a former constituent. Okay. And get the details, because I think it's a story worth looking at.
Okay.
But do you guys track that kind of response, I was treated through the process?
We have an ALJ survey that we do annually. We do 4-year reviews, and those are requests by the public to talk about how they feel about our administrative law judges. And we have actually specific information request from mediation on mediations about how people feel about that process. So those are the kinds of things we do to try to track satisfaction with the services we provide.
Thank you. Oh, don't mind me. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Why is everyone so quiet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am John Schultz. I'm the administrator with the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My presentation, of course, is on the Workers' Compensation Division, and you can find information on this right behind the Workers' Compensation Board tab in the Workers' Compensation Division tab. And on page 1, you can see how we are structured inside of the division. Our mission is to efficiently and impartially administer and enforce the workers' compensation law as it's negotiated by management and labor. The goals of the division are to ensure that, number one, employers are providing workers' compensation insurance for their workers. Number two, that workers receive their benefits that they're supposed to receive. In other words, they receive accurate benefits, and they receive them on time. Number three, our goal is to ensure that there's timely resolution of disputes that come before us. Number four, that injured workers promptly return to work, and that they return to work at a wage as close as possible to the wage they were making at the time of injury. Five, that our rules and bulletins and other communications are clear and easily understood, which sounds very straightforward, but it can be a challenge inside of workers' compensation. And six, that we effectively manage the costs of the division, and that we're efficient in our operations. As a little bit of background, you heard some from Greg and a little bit from Maureen. We talked about the three-way system on Thursday last week, and Oregon became a three-way system in 1965. And what that means is that employers can get their insurance in three different ways. They can insure through the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation. They can insure through a private insurer, or in some circumstances, they can become self-insured. Our obligation is to ensure that employers are getting their insurance in one of those three ways. again, by way of history, a little bit about the system itself. In the late 1980s, we were the sixth most expensive system in the nation, and our benefits for workers were quite poor as compared to other states. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, we began to go through a reform process which created some new processes for the workers' compensation system in Oregon, and most specifically I want to mention that Oregon had a change in the causation standard for workers to be able to access the system in 1990. We went to what is known as a major contributing cause standard in Oregon. There was quite a bit of resources directed towards safety efforts in Oregon. There were a lot of resources directed towards return to work efforts in Oregon to get injured workers back to work as soon as possible. And specifically in terms of the Workers' Compensation Division, in addition to being called upon to support return to work efforts, we were also asked to support administrative dispute resolution. Today, as compared to pre-reform, Oregon is much less expensive in terms of the cost of workers' compensation. We do have better benefits for injured workers. There are many less injured workers today in the system, and that's because there are less workers being injured, and also because of the causation standard is tougher in Oregon. And those who are injured tend to be less disabled today. There's less degrees of disability for injured workers when their claims are closed today than there were previously, and I believe that's because of safety efforts and better claims management and return to work efforts. The Workers' Compensation Division, as Greg discussed on Thursday, is funded by the premium assessment, which is currently an 8% assessment on premium that employers pay. It is collected by the insurance companies and forwarded to the division. And under the Workers' Compensation System tab, which is a couple of tabs back on pages 7 and 8, there's quite a summary about the premium assessment operating account and what those expenditures go towards paying for. And you can see on the bottom of page 7 in the box under expenditures, workers' compensation premium operating account expenditures by program, the various programs where the premium assessment goes. And the Workers' Compensation Division is part of that, as is the Insurance Division, a small part of that, the Workers' Compensation Board, Oregon, OSHA, etc. It's in the executive. I'm sorry, I should have noted this. It's in the executive summary. Under the system.
Oh, the system tab.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. And it's on page 7 where I was referencing under the system tab. Everybody have a chance to find that.
I haven't got a system tab. That's the grid.
I think it just precedes the grid.
The other funding mechanism is the Workers' Benefit Fund, which, for those of you who do have the system information, that's on pages, summary of that is on pages 9 and 10. And the Workers' Benefit Fund is used primarily to provide benefits to injured workers under a number of programs, the most important being the Retroactive Reserve Program, where there are increased benefits provided to claimants who are injured under benefit schedules that are lower than today's schedules. So an example of that would be an injured worker who might have a permanent and total disability declared, let's say, in 1985. Since 1985, there's been quite a bit of inflation, cost of living increases. the insurer will pay the worker the benefits that are due them under the benefit schedule that was in place in 1985, and the retroactive reserve program, which we manage, will make up the difference close to what a worker would be collecting today. So that's an example of how the retroactive program works. There are several other applications for it. The second biggest program is the reemployment assistance program, which is used as incentives for employers to hire injured workers under a couple of programs, which I'll get into in more detail in a minute. And also I intend to, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, to address your question from last week about rehabilitation at that time. The core functions for the Workers' Compensation Division are pretty straightforward. We regulate benefit delivery and employer coverage, as I mentioned before. We resolve disputes. We support injured worker return to work. And we provide information to a variety of in a variety of areas, and to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, of course, to the legislature, to workers and labor, insurers, employers, physicians, etc., other stakeholders to the system. I'll provide a little background in these four areas. The workers' compensation is working daily to ensure that employers provide workers' compensation insurance. Last year, we conducted employer compliance investigations and did determine that 688 employers were non-compliant last year. We issued over $8 million in penalties to those non-compliant employers. We do conduct coverage review and coordination in an effort to prevent employers from becoming non-compliant. We track termination notices from insurers to employers when their insurance is being terminated, and we notified nearly 24,000 employers last year that their insurance had been terminated, and followed up with these employers and basically asked, are you sure you don't need workers' compensation insurance, in an effort to prevent employers from being non-compliant. It's very expensive if you're caught being non-compliant in the system.
Do we have a process to, if an employer makes that mistake, I mean, sure, they're going to pay the fines and they should, but do we have a method of directing them how they might be able to, you know, access coverage? And, I mean, do we help them? Do we support them to make sure they get legal?
Chair George, yes, we do. We contact them, and if they, and if we determine that they should have workers' compensation insurance, or we come to a consensus with the employer that they should have workers' compensation insurance, we give them a few weeks to come into compliance. We don't hit them with the fine immediately. We give them 2 weeks to obtain insurance. If they have problems obtaining insurance, typically sometimes small business will run into problems, we'll connect them with the small business ombudsman to assist them in getting insurance.
Thanks.
Did you,
Senator Carter, then Representative Smith.
I am so sorry. I was rude.
That's all right.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
But I was so you get first.
I was just gung-ho on the fact in reference to this department and past times. Why don't you just walk them through a little bit about how many times you really try to call employers who are non-compliant? Because once before, you guys even take it back to the board and they talk and all this kind of stuff. So it's not just 2 weeks. There's a process to use, and I think it would be interesting to this panel to hear that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I was probably brief in my summary of what we do. We have a staff that does make phone calls on a regular basis to employers. We follow up with letters. We make a lot of effort to try to keep an employer from being non-compliant because we recognize it is very expensive to do that. So we go through quite a process with employers. Secondly, if an employer is found to be non-compliant and is hit with a fine, we try to work with that employer. We don't want to put them out of business. A lot of employers don't want to work with us under those circumstances, but we do have what we call a contested cases unit. We work with the employer. We will settle with the employer in terms of the fine that's due to try to keep them in business, try to keep the workers there. Occasionally, that doesn't work out. and the employer will leave the state. But we do go through quite a process to notify employers, work with them through phone calls, through letters, warn them, try to prevent them from falling into that category, and then once they're in that category, to work with them to try to prevent them from going out of business, because the fines can be large.
Thank you, Chair George. I'm looking through the revenues and disbursements, and I'm not a pulp, or not meaning to digress. But earlier in the written description of your budget, you have investment income, and then under revenues and disbursements, I don't see where that line item is. I only see interest income. Are those two the same?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I just wanted to make sure. I believe they were, and then I did check, and yes, they are the same.
So that follow-up question. Mm-hmm. So that interest revenue is earnings from fund balances invested by the Oregon Investment Council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, they are.
Follow-up question. Mm-hmm. What are the limitations on the uses of those dollars? Are those dollars that the legislature has the ability to use for other purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I would like to be able to get back to the committee with an answer on that to make sure I give you a correct answer. I have a belief on that, but I want to make sure and give you the right answer.
Chair George, my observation is if those are interest earnings from the fund balances on the workers' benefit fund, there's about $17 million, and on the workers' compensation assessment account, there's about $4.4 million. And I'd just be very interested in knowing what the limitations are on those dollars, and knowing if there's just statutory limitations on those, or if there's some other reason why those dollars couldn't be somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman.
And maybe this is the highest and best use. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mr. Chair, what? Oh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, those are dedicated funds. We can provide you the statutory citation if it would be of any assistance to you.
Secretary?
I just want to tell Representative Smith, it's as hard as pulling teeth from a chicken to
what is?
It's as hard as pulling teeth from a chicken for the legislature to touch those dollars. So they're secured. It wasn't the legislature. Ask me. I've been there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the second area of responsibility for the Workers' Compensation Division, we ensure that injured workers are receiving timely and accurate benefits. And in order to do this, we conduct field audit of insurers and self-insured employers. In the last year, we conducted 156 audits of insurers and 252 audits of self-insured employers. We conducted 79 investigations in regard to the accuracy and timeliness of benefit allegations. We issued over 568 penalties to insurers in the last year because of...
Help us where you are right now. Are we back under the division?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We're in the Workers' Compensation Division section. I'm just providing more data in terms of the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Division, in terms of what we do.
That's page number?
Page 2.
Okay. Thank you. So you're lost now. I put a paper in my head, so I knew where to go.
Mr. Chair, I'm just speaking to the Workers' Compensation Division's responsibility to ensure that workers are getting the benefits that they're due and that they're getting them on time.
Can I just interrupt you? Based upon what we were just talking about with Representative Smith, if in fact a worker is working for an employer that has not provided compensation insurance, and this worker becomes injured. Now, I mean, are they left on their own just to file a lawsuit trying to collect damages, or is there a, I see somebody shaking their head, no, they're not left on their own. How would we make sure that that person was properly taken care of who had been injured and unknowingly was working for someone who was not covered?
Mr. Chair, the Workers' Compensation Division is responsible to ensure that the worker is a subject worker, first of all, and then to inside the workers' compensation statute, and that the employer should have been providing workers' compensation insurance. Once we have made that determination, we refer the injured worker's claim to our assigned claims agent, and they process the worker's claim. The costs for the claim, as well as penalties, are supposed to be paid for by the non-compliant employer, and in some cases they are. In some cases, we are unable to collect that money for the injured worker, in which case the cost for the worker's claims ultimately comes out of the premium assessment operating account. So the Workers' Compensation Division is overseeing the management of that process.
Is there a point at which that worker could, because the person had not provided himself with, the employer had not provided himself with the protection of the system, can they directly sue that that employer?
Mr. Chair, no, they can't.
They cannot.
Unless they fall into a couple of the exceptions inside of workers' compensation law, which will allow a worker under certain circumstances to pursue an employer in a tort action.
Senator Morris, thank you. That was very helpful for me.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Do most of the disputes arise out of the independent contractor determination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, in many of the disputes that we do see in regard to whether or not a worker is a subject worker or whether or not the employer is a subject employer do come about in terms of the independent contractor issue. Most of the disputes inside of the Workers' Compensation Division, however, are for other items such as whether or not the injury is compensable or a medical eligibility dispute or some other reason. But there, in terms of the whether or not the employer is a compliant employer, we do see disputes like that. Yes.
Senator Morris,
follow-up question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those that are determined to be independent contractors, they are responsible for paying their own workers' comp, or are they just totally outside the system? And then if they are injured, what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if the employer is determined to be a subject employer, they are responsible for providing workers' compensation insurance to their employees. If the employee is determined to be an independent contractor and not a subject worker, the injured worker, is determined to be, then they do not have workers' compensation coverage.
Which one of you was first? Representative Krieger.
Or George. This definition, or however how you decide who a subject worker is or a subject employer, how does that apply to family-owned businesses where maybe it's a partnership, maybe it isn't, maybe it's a corporation? And I'm kind of thinking of the lines of small ranch and farm operations that different family members work on, maybe part-time or full-time, maybe on a weekend, helping get a hay in, and also in commercial fish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, there is an election that can be made by the employer, not only to cover themselves with workers' compensation insurance, but also to cover their corporate officers. If that election is not made and they elect not to cover themselves or not to elect their corporate officers, which sometimes people elect not to do, then those individuals would not be subject workers and not subject to the workers' compensation statutes. In regard to I'm trying to remember the term and it's escaping me now, but they're in regard to, I think it's casual labor.
Casual labor and then family members.
Casual labor and family members. They're often excluded from the workers' compensation law unless there is a specific election made in terms of the policy for coverage. And in Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, in regard to commercial fishing, I would have to do some research on that. That's going beyond my memory at this point.
Thank you.
Again, I'm digressing. Going back to the revenues and disbursements on both the compensation premium assessment account and the benefit fund, I'm looking at the ending balances. I'm curious why those ending balances are so large, and I'm wondering perhaps if analysis has been done to see if, for example, on the workers' benefit fund, if that ending balance, if it was reduced, what that would translate into in terms of lowering the compensation premium taxes and the assessments on cents per hour. For example, when I look at the ending balance, it's $139 million, and yet the total expenditures are only $210,000. That's a huge, huge ending balance. And again, I'm not an expert in this, but that perhaps someone could explain to me or show me in writing the need for such a large ending balance. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, in the workers' compensation premium assessment account, the ending balance of $139 million is approximately a two-quarter fund balance for the workers' compensation premium assessment. The total expenditures, I was reading the wrong line. I apologize. The workers' compensation premium assessment, the ending balance is $49 million, which is roughly half of the total expenditure of $95 million. It is a six-month. We try to adopt and keep a six-month or two-quarter fund balance. That is statutory, and it's something that we were required to do. Now, the numbers may vary a little bit around. It's hard to hit it exactly. So in this particular case, our ending balance is just a tad high in terms of the 6 month. So yes, that would be taken into account in terms of whether we would lower, or if it was low, or raise the assessment rate for the next year.
Follow-up question. If the policy of the system is to have a 6 month balance, and it's just a slight bit high, and we know during these times every penny matters, is there an opportunity for us to get that number to exactly 6 months and to take some of that interest income and put it into something that perhaps is a higher priority?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was action taken, I can't remember how many biennia ago, to direct the agency to reduce the fund balances to, I believe it was at that time, 6 months. And that introduces a great deal of volatility into the system. And ultimately, if you take a look at the history, you'll see that the rates were significantly lowered for a period of time while they spent down their balance, but then had to double in order to maintain the ending balance. And the legislature then went back and said that I think for the workers' benefit fund, it's supposed to be a 12-month ending balance.
So a follow-up question. So a six-month ending balance is insufficient.
We have two different, I believe, and I'll let them answer, but we have two different criteria for the two different funds. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the workers' compensation premium assessment account, we have a six-month fund balance requirement. For the workers' benefit fund, we have a 12-month fund balance requirement.
Follow-up question.
Certainly.
That's okay. So the six-month requirement is a statutory requirement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, it is.
Follow-up question. Mm-hmm. What I would be interested in knowing is if what I understand is we have just over a six-month. We have 6 months and a little bit of extra there. I would be very interested in knowing what that little extra is and knowing if that money could, say, come out of interest income and could be better utilized elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith.
What am I missing here? I feel like I'm missing something.
The rate setting for 2004 is projected to go down to 6.7%, which would impact the fund balance. In terms of the worker benefit fund balance, that we also adjust that rate annually as well. So if there is additional money in the fund balance, that's an opportunity for us to lower the assessment rates.
I apologize. I just want to make sure I understand this. If a candy bar costs a dollar and we have a dollar and 3 cents, you go buy the candy bar, you spend your dollar, you still have 3 cents left over. Why is there an opportunity for us to take that 3 cents and use that for something different? And granted, it's only 3 cents, but 3 cents in this environment is a lot of money. What am I missing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the point they were trying to make is that if, in fact, at the end of 6 months, when they are contemplating the rate adjustment in either of these accounts, if, in fact, their projections are that the account is going to have too much money, the rate will be reduced. So there is a self-correcting mechanism that goes on here. That's why the rates fluctuate, and that's why they're projecting a lower rate out into the future. And the interest earnings go back into the fund and are dedicated for the purposes for which the fund is dedicated. And they're part of the mechanism that keeps the rate, you know, somewhat stable.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but basically if we build the reserves, we build the interest, and we get to this point where we're 6 months or, depending on the count, 12 months, what happens then is just returned to the ratepayers by a reduction in rate.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct.
Okay. The light bulb went on.
Huh?
Thank you.
I just also want to say, Representative Smith, that that is the board is a very high-level, very powerful, very involved group of people. These guys carry out the statutory implementation, but the board sets the policy. So it's those business people that are working together to protect the fund, and you have the unions on there that is taking care of their best interest and that the worker is protected. So it is a what I call a fail-safe system. And I think that together, over the years, Oregon has had a secured life system, if you will, simply because of the powerfulness of the board. And all these guys do is implement what the board has said that they're going to do. But it is a fail-safe system where if after 6 months too much money has been collected, they readdress the issue and the costs to businesses go down. And believe me, they have worked very hard. For instance, we had a very high unemployment rate in Northeast Portland, and we developed the Skill Center. It took me 4 months talking to the board, the governor, and everybody else to get them to help with structural unemployment in Northeast Portland. And so this is one board that has worked very hard and very well. And just say to the legislature, the only redeeming power you have is that if you're working on behalf of workers and everything else to get. But I understand your point. You're saying why don't we use another fund in order to raise to help get better interest rates in that 3 cents that you gave as an example.
My concern, Chair, was that that ending balance wasn't being adjusted, and that there perhaps was a small savings there.
That's exactly.
But my
and
question
that you can
was
better use that money, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I do want to address, with your permission, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes' question regarding what happened with rehabilitation based on some of the cuts that we recommended and were carried out last biennium.
Mr. Chair, members, could you explain to the committee what did happen last biennium? Because there's a lot of members on this committee that weren't here, and so they don't know the history.
Yes. Mr. Chair, last biennium, the Department of Consumer and Business Services did recommend several cuts inside of the department because we could see that the premium assessment operating account was not going to be sufficient in the future to pay for all of our operations. We went to the Management Labor Advisory Committee and discussed and negotiated through a series of meetings and came forward with an agreement and proposal to the Ways and Means Committee, which consisted of a small increase in the premium assessment from 7.3% to 8%, reduction of 17 positions inside of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, as well as some transfer from the Worker Benefit Fund to the operational expenses inside of some parts of the Workers' Compensation Division. In regard to the 17 positions that were eliminated, there were a couple of programs that were clearly impacted by that. The one that I'm responsible for, that Senator Dukes asked about last Thursday, was our preferred, what is known as the Preferred Worker Program, which is a program that is designed to assist permanently disabled injured workers to return to employment in a job that is suitable considering their physical capacities. The cut that we made in the Preferred Worker Program was to eliminate three positions in our Worksite Modification Program. And these are consultants that work with employers and workers to develop appropriately modified work sites to allow injured workers to go back to work. A lot of times it's with the employer at injury, or it could be with a new employer. What happened over the last biennium is that we have been, and previous to last biennium, is that we had been seeing a reduction in the amount of preferred workers who were coming to us and seeking services. On page 4, under the Workers' Compensation Division tab, at the top of that page, there is a small matrix, and the second to last subject there is preferred worker contracts. And it starts in calendar year 1996 and runs through calendar year 2001. And you can see that there has been a considerable reduction in the amount of preferred worker contracts. Now, what those are contracts where we are assisting an employer to place a permanently disabled worker back to work. And we are providing incentives, in usually in the form of wage subsidy, or where we provide premium exemption to the employer where they don't have to pay workers' compensation premium on this worker. If this worker is re-injured in the first 3 years or suffers a new injury, they won't be responsible for that. The Workers' Compensation Division pays for that. But what we were seeing in the workers' compensation system generally, as you can see up in the third line under accepted disabling claims, has been a reduction in the amount of injured workers that have disabling claims in general. Now, this is a trend that in the preferred worker contracts, where we were seeing a lot less preferred workers coming in and using the preferred worker system. So what's happened since we cut those positions? Since we cut those positions, we have served 570 injured workers in 2001 in regard to worksite modification contracts that we were able to put back to work, and 438 workers in 2002. All parts of the program have continued, and all workers who requested services were provided services. There was no drop in service to the injured workers. We also added a component to the program called the Job Match Program, where we now list openings on our website that where employers are requesting preferred workers to apply. And we have quite a few openings right now. So if anybody knows a preferred worker, we've got some jobs listed for us. The number of requests coming into the Preferred Worker Program and definitely the Worksite Modification Program appear pretty stable right now. They seem to have leveled off. We were seeing some pretty dramatic drops in the number of workers that were coming into the program. It certainly is at a reduced level as compared to a couple of years ago. We think that's over the last couple of quarters that was over the last couple of years that we were seeing the economy play a part in that. But it seems to have leveled off at this point in time. So in answer to your question, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we were able to serve every injured worker that requested services through the Preferred Worker Program, and we were able to serve every employer and worker specifically in the Job Worksite Modification Program. So we were able to take those cuts and have no drop in service at this point. I did want to also address, Mr. Chair, with your permission, Representative Krieger's question about a plan for customer service. We have developed the capacity over the last biennium to perform statistically significant customer satisfaction surveys, and we have been surveying customers. Primarily, so far, we have completed an employer survey, we've completed an injured worker survey, we have a managed care organization survey that's still underway, we have several surveys that are underway at this point in time. What we really are trying to focus in on is the areas where customers are identifying certain services or processes of being very highly important to them, but where they may not be getting a high level of satisfaction. In other words, we're trying to identify something of high importance, but we're not performing well. Is there low satisfaction going on? We're also tracking our performance measures, and this also gives us an opportunity to look at areas where internally we can identify where we may not be performing as well as we want to. We have trained every employee in the Workers' Compensation Division in a process improvement model, which is the model is basically a total quality management type of model, again, where we're using high importance and low satisfaction information and focusing in on what can we change about our processes. Are we too slow? Do we not provide enough information? Where are we dropping the ball and try to improve our processes to achieve higher levels of customer satisfaction? We also try to make changes to the system with our stakeholders at the table. An example of that would be currently we're engaged in looking at our medical fees. We regulate the fees that can be charged for certain types of medical services. We're looking at those fees with insurers, physicians, employers, and injured worker representatives at the table with us so that they can be satisfied with the outcome.
If I look at your data on page 4 of WCD, it seems inconsistent to me because the number of employers went up and the number of disabling claims went down and the number of workers you have to process or to do all the things you need to have done has gone down. And that seemed a little inconsistent to me. How are you still, are as many people still in the system? Are you having as many workers in the system as you did during this period of time? Did you have less claims because less people were injured, or did you have less claims as a result of not having the workers there to get the job done? I mean, this seems inconsistent to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we are seeing less disabled workers in the system today. The accepted disabling claims rate is definitely going down. It appears to be a national phenomenon, and Oregon is tracking right with it. We're just seeing a lot less workers coming into the system. We track the disabling claims because the non-disabling claims typically resolve very quickly. The disabling claims tend to be longer and require more assistance.
One follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Are we seeing less accidents happen on the job? Is OSHA, and are we seeing less accidents as a result of you're seeing fewer disabled workers, or what is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, yes, we're definitely seeing less accidents on the job.
That's kind of good.
Senator Deuce, then Senator Morris.
What year did we change the workers' comp law?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Mahoney Hall thing.
Senator Dukes, that was not. I believe you're referring to the Mahoney Hall, 1990.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How can we forget?
Because I suspect that that has something to do with your statistics. People who used to be considered disabled aren't considered disabled anymore. Might not be able to work, but they're not disabled under our laws.
That's why I was asking this question.
Yeah, I think that we've got people out there who sort of fall, and I can't recall the term, and everybody who works in workers' comp knows it, the one that says that, especially construction folks, if you've been working different employers for years, nobody's responsible, or everybody's equally responsible, so therefore, you know, don't get the help you need, so. I suspect that has something to do with the statistics.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I suspect that you are correct. We did have a study performed, not during this last interim, but the interim before, by Michigan State University, to look at the effects of the major contributing cause standard. The major contributing cause standard was the standard that Oregon adopted in the 1990s, and it basically is a causation standard to determine what are the causes of the disability or the need for treatment. And under Oregon law, work has to be the major contributing cause for the disability or the need for treatment, or the claim is not compensable under the workers' compensation law. So it's definitely a higher causation standard here in Oregon than in many other states. The results from Michigan State University, basically they determined that there was a mix of factors that were going into contributing to the decline we were seeing in accepted disabling claims. And one of the factors certainly was the major contributing cause standard. However, that they felt that there were better safety efforts, and in fact that was more of was a larger cause, they felt at that time. If you would like, I'd be more than happy to get a copy of that study.
It won't change anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, in changes, it isn't any one thing that causes a multitude of things. I'm wondering if one of those factors that was considered is the changing composition of our workforce, from focusing on, you know, what typically has been a higher risk job classification to lower risk, high emphasis on high-tech service. And so I just suggest that. I'm not sure whether the study analyzed that or not, but I wonder to what degree that is also a part of the mix.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the study from Michigan State University, if I recall, did not report out findings on that particular issue. Certainly we have talked about that and looked at that. What we do know is as the woods industry employment has declined, and certainly we used to see a lot of devastating injuries coming out of the woods. As that has declined, however, we have seen quite a bit of increase in construction employment in the state. And there's people who argue both sides of that question. We do know there's a couple other factors, though, that probably ought to be noted. One is our aging workforce in Oregon. And typically those who are older do not get injured as often. They typically work safer, work smarter. However, when they have a disability, it tends to last longer. It can be harder to resolve. And then secondly, the employment rates play a large role in this. As we see more people who are unemployed, there are less workers' compensation claims. On the other hand, there are those who argue, and I'll throw myself in this camp, that when the economy is bad, people do what they can to maintain their incomes for their families, and stretching out a workers' compensation claim can sometimes be a strategy that somebody will employ if they have to.
But also staying safe is one, too.
That's a good springboard for the question I had, and I think there is a major cultural change within employers' attitudes. I go back to, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember how we used to look at things and how we look at them now. I mean, I think I am almost fanatical about worker safety as compared to my employers. And I know how the approach used to be. And all of the safety equipment that's now on every piece of machinery that you're dealing with, and you have procedures that you make sure they understand. And the fact that now it isn't like someone's forcing us to do that as employers. We're wanting to do it because we realize. I've never seen an employer that didn't feel bad about an employer being injured while they were working for that person. So do you guys perceive that? I mean, do you get less resistance and more people willing to, particularly today where a lot of equipment comes with the safety features built in? And that's why I kind of think these numbers are going down. I think there's a cultural change.
Mr. Chair, Pete DeLuca, who's the administrator of the Oregon OSHA division, will cover this, I'm sure. I will attempt to provide some answer to this question. I've been working in the workers' compensation system for a long time. I go back a long ways, and I agree. I think there is a tremendous cultural shift by employers in regard to safety, in regard to how they consider their employees. An attitude that we used to encounter was that an injured worker was a disposable resource. I rarely encounter that anymore. I think that a lot of employers try to get their workers back to work. I also think that there's been a tremendous shift in the medical community where they see return to work as therapy, as part of what's good for the worker. And I think those factors are definitely different than they were 20 years ago.
Representative Krieger.
Chair George, it's interesting in the conversation from the two senators here. I've been working with a constituent for 6 or 7 months over a past injury. And for looking at the process and the appeals and the difference of opinions of different doctors, who some of them I think safe just got a doctor, they got a full call, no. And that's my opinion. I don't much appreciate it. I went to this guy's house unexpectedly at 10 o'clock tonight to see just how bad he was. And I'm telling you, when I walked out of there, I about had tears in my eyes. And I've been working on it for, like I say, 6 months, and I'm not going to quit till it's taken care of. But there are some real atrocities taking place out there. And I think it's going to get worse now that we have a bad economy and there's pressures on the Save Corporation and that. But there's things going on that shouldn't be allowed to happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I agree. There definitely are in the workers' compensation system. The system is far from perfect.
Yeah. There needs to be an attitude change somewhere. And I think the legislature needs to be taking part in making that happen.
Well, we personally, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we're kind of in the general heading of grousing about some things that happen. the types of complaints that I get come under a couple of headings. One is the status of the previous injury causes a lot of concern with workers that had been previously injured and then other. The other one is the timeliness sometimes of benefits. That somebody I had a lineman that had fallen off a tower. There was no question it was a workman's compensation injury. There was a dispute over what was the best course of treatment. The family had went 2 months before they and hadn't seen a check yet. Now you fall in October, and you haven't seen money going into Christmas. I mean, there are very few families that can tolerate that type of an interruption. Along with, they were paying the costs of drugs and treatment. And this was while the dispute was going on between two doctors in terms of whether the man needed surgery or whether there was another form of treatment. So that timeliness seems to, and I've heard that from some other people, just how it doesn't, things happen and the first check doesn't get there quite when anybody expects it. Well, if a normal lag time of 2 or 3 weeks or a month, maybe families can tolerate that. But when problems come that cause, I refer them to the ombudsman, and then I don't hear a whole lot back later. But the one that caused me, I think, the most concern, I had I had a constituent that had been off on an injury, was going through a retraining program through the community college, was getting a stipend for living expenses. He received a letter from the insurance company saying that they were that they no longer felt that his injury was warranted continuing to retrain, and stopped his benefits. This occurred like January 8th. Of course, he had a right to appeal it. The problem was, if he appealed and lost, then there was no way for him to either recover the cost of his community college tuition or his living expenses for the period waiting for the appeal. If he didn't sign up for college and didn't continue his training, then he'd be turned down because he wasn't continuing his at least the way he explained it to me, that he wouldn't be continuing his training, so he would no longer be eligible for. So he said, you know, I can't win either way, so he went back to work. And probably that wasn't the best judgment and the best, because he'd injured himself several different times. His employer wasn't real excited about him coming back to work. But you wonder the timeliness of how this came back, that it, because of the timing of the insurance company, there was no way for him to really continue on. And when I see, you know, I don't get a lot of constituent complaints, but probably 30-40% of them relate to workers' comp in one way or another. And there seems to be a kind of this common theme that some workers aren't taken care of in the same way that we would expect.
Senator Dukes.
I throw my 2 cents worth in everything Representative Hansen just said, and Representative Krueger too. I've seen as well. It seems that too often the system seems to forget that these are people that are injured. It seems as though we're in such a hurry to rout out somebody who might be trying to abuse the system that we penalize everybody who gets into the system. Well, not everybody. A lot of people, you know, cut their hand at work, go to the emergency room, get it taken care of, go home with a prescription for Vicodin, and you know, end up back at work. But the harder core, the more expensive cases, I get very frustrated with a system where when I get one of the a call from someone who's in the inner workings of a hardcore case, I have to recommend that they hire an attorney. At that point, they don't have the money, and I know that, but that is their only recourse if they want fair treatment in the system. And so I think Representative Krueger's alternative to this is, in terms of us trying to do something, is a good one, but it's very frustrating. These are people who lose their homes, they lose their spouses and their families and every shred of dignity that they had, just trying to prove that they're really injured.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay, that was my 2 cents.
We just received notice that we're going to need to be out of here in just a few minutes. One of the things I would just like to say, and I'm glad you folks are here.
This must be the other committee.
Right, and that is, I've always personally believed that the legislature was, in fact, the people's advocates, and I think you've heard that here today, that is the case, and this is probably the most frustrating thing. My question, if you guys would be able to get us some information before we get back here tomorrow, would be, is there any comparison between our providers? And I personally experienced one in which one of the privates just did an absolute beyond the call of duty response to an injured worker, then watching another one that I felt was way short. And do we monitor the complaint rates or anything like that that we get from folks relative to individual providers? Because I've seen personally a difference, and I think that's something that should be monitored, and I'm just sort of curious if they do.
Mr. Chair, can I answer your question?
Yes.
A couple of questions. Mm-hmm. One or two. What I would like to know is what happens when a worker is in mid-year in a program, in a college program that had been satisfied by all persons involved? What happens at that point in terms of the, working to the end of the term, or what are the consequences? What happens? And then I'd also like to know what happens when the medical community is at odds in terms of treatment. Because just to give you just a short example, so I know you would get to leave. It happened that my son didn't worry about it because it was a short period of time, but for 13 years, my son, who was 38 last year and had surgery, a doctor who did not believe in surgery was treating him for a back problem. And finally, somebody told him in the system where you were the doctor doesn't believe in surgery. And he changed doctors because he was not able to walk. And this doctor said, your problem could have been settled 13 years ago had you not been with a doctor who did not believe in surgery, but treating in some form of treatment. And for 13 years, he had been enduring this pain, and now he's just like a jumping ball all over everywhere, playing basketball and everything, when all he needed was just, you know, to get this back fusion that he needs. So what happens in those situations? So I'd like to see us walk through.
Okay, well, I want to thank everyone for being here, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5011. That will be adjourned. Oh,